Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Folks, this is Elvin Shamrock. My sincerest apologies for the late start. I'm actually conducting this teleseminar from overseas, and I forgot that we had changed our clocks last week. So I'm an hour out, and I was sitting here minding my own business when Karina, who works with me, let me know, listen, you better get on right away. So I apologize for the delay. But we are here nevertheless, and thank you very much for joining. As always, I start by just giving the rules of the game. We have two people who have submitted questions regarding cases on their list. I took a brief look at them before earlier today, and they're both very relevant questions for every single person taking the exam. What the discussion is going to be is completely unscripted. We'll see where it takes us. And as always, I always remind you folks that I will always mention the candidate's only the candidate's first name. I never mention the last name, so anonymity is assured. Excuse me. I've also muted everyone out, because we can't have tons of people talking at the same time. So the only people who are unmuted are our active participants and myself. And with that, let's just see if our active participants are with us. Firstly, there is Akshay. Akshay, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, thank you so much for joining and welcome. And finally, Kate. Kate, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, and thank you to you and welcome as well. I've got your case that you sent in the email, but for the sake of everyone listening online now, why don't you just present your case very briefly, and then we can discuss it and dissect down, drill down on the issues at hand.
Yeah, sure. So 43-year-old GTP. To underwent the TAA.
So I'm gonna start critiquing you folks with a touch of oral exam technique. Number one, probably you folks didn't notice, but when I asked him the question, if you want to present your case, actually his first response was, sure. Now, when you're a candidate and the examiner asks you any question and you respond, sure, before you even start the response proper, you've already sent a signal, a message to your examiner that you're comfortable for this conversation. And that scores points at a psychological level. So I want to commend you on that. And I'm going to, excuse me, critique you on another issue. And that is, he said she's P2G2. Okay, or G2, P2. The point that I'm getting at is I don't want you to verbally overuse abbreviations. There is that list of recognized abbreviations that ABOG has in their bulletin, in one of the appendices. Even that, it's not an absolute, it's more of a guideline in my opinion, but that doesn't apply to how you speak verbally in the exam. But I'm going to tell you, from the oral exam perspective, I encourage you to use abbreviations where appropriate, but not to overuse them. So I think it just sounds more professional to say she's a Gravita 2 Para 2. Rather than GNP. So I'm not going to say it's wrong, but I just want you to think about this and get a feel for what is a decent level of abbreviation in your verbal speech. So actually, sorry, I apologize, I interrupted, but go ahead.
Okay. So 42-year-old Gravita 2, Para 2, underwent a total abdominal hysterectomy with right salpingo-oophorectomy, left salpingectomy, lysis adhesion, due to abnormal uterine bleeding, uterine leiomyoma, uterine polyp. She also had a history of C-section, cesarean delivery times 2, and she has failed medical management. She stayed in the hospital for a total of 7 days, which involved a urology consult due to a left ureteral injury. She was readmitted for pyelonephritis, for which she received IV antibiotics and another urology consult. Her pathology of the specimen was notable for a 337-gram uterus, leiomyoma, right ovary with focal endometriosis, and benign cervix, endometrium, and fallopian tube.
Okay, so look, everyone who's hearing you present the case, all of us, we got to look at each case from 40,000 feet as well as from 10,000 feet. But when we look at this case from 40,000 feet, this case, actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but this case is really about a ureteric injury. Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if that's where the main thrust of the conversation is going to be, then when you present it initially, give it a little bit extra detail. Not too much, because you don't want to give everything, but give a little bit extra detail. You almost just flew straight over it without commenting virtually at all about it. And I'd like you just to say a little bit more. So with that in mind, I noticed you had a left ureteral injury. That was the side where you left the ovary behind. You took the tube out on the left and the tube and ovary out on the right. So what happened? How did you counsel her? She was 42 years old. Why did you take the right ovary? Why did you not take the left ovary? How do you think the injury occurred?
So the right ovary was not scheduled. The reason why the right ovary was taken was due to poor hemostasis. And so that's a right.
Okay, so that's a perfect answer, by the way, because you put any concerns that I'm playing the role of examiner to rest, that you're not whipping out ovaries on a 40-something-year-old unless you really have to. So that's great. Okay, so we'll come back to the lack of hemostasis in a moment. So, and I guess the left ovary was likewise planned to be left in situ, and it was.
Correct.
Okay, so let me jump to Kate. Kate, are you for a second? We're not leaving you, actually. Kate, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Did you hear the presentation thus far?
Yep.
If you were the examiner, what question or two are you dying to hear from Akshay as he defends his case? What bits of information would you love to hear? There's no trick here. So whatever.
He
concerned you.
I guess where, I mean, maybe he said this and I missed it, but where was the location of the ureteric injury determined to be?
That's exactly right. And it's not only where is the injury, but also, actually, I advise everyone else, it's recommended, but you have to know the course of the ureter, because they're going to ask you this, and it's going to come up in how did it happen, and where along the course of the year did it happen? So thanks, Kate. You're exactly spot on. The point why I'm doing this is to show you folks that you can work out where the conversation is going to go. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. So Akshay, tell us what happened intra-op as far as this ureteric injury is concerned.
Yeah, so intra-op, there's actually no concern for ureteric injury. We visualize the uterus far away from all our clamps. On post-op day one, patient reported of left flank pain along with a rising creatinine.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second, and I apologize. You said, or I think I read you, that you had a 7-centimeter fibroid making up a 337-gram mm-hmm. uterus. So a substantial-sized uterus. Mm-hmm. Was this fibroid located more to one side that was perhaps meeting, impinging on the sidewall?
No, sir. It was right in the middle.
Okay. All right. That's important to say, by the way, you know, because we're trying to find out the examiner. I'm just telling you what's going to happen in your conversation. And, folks, what I'm going to take actually through with them now is the same for all of you who've got complications. The examiner is going to want to know, how did it happen? Is there anything you could have done differently to avoid it from happening in the first place? Then how did you diagnose it? What did you do about it? And the final cherry on the top is, as a consequence of this complication, is there anything you do differently now moving forward to reduce the risk of a repeat of this episode? That's the general track of any complication that any of you may have on your cases, and I want you to be comfortable to have that conversation regarding those issues. So actually, back to you. Go ahead. What happened?
Right. Intraoperatively, there was no concern for a urethral injury. However, on post-op day one, there was left flank pain complained by the patient and a rise in creatinine level, as well as oligouria. Patient was not voiding. And then we put a Foley in, and about a liter of urine came out. So there was concern for urethral injury, and a CT urogram was
Hold on a second. You got a liter of urine from the contralateral kidney, obviously, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Okay, carry on. I just want to make sure that I understand everything.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so she was still voiding, but it was not was not as much as we would have expected. And then the CT urogram showed extravagation of contrast on the left ureter. So.
And this was all on post-op day one?
Yep, day one, day two.
Okay, fine. So, folks, timing when it comes to post-op complications as a generalization is very important. And those of you that have complications, it's probably worthwhile. I mean, I've got to look at it each one individually, but it's probably worthwhile to say POD hashtag, post-op day number 2-1, whatever the case may be, left flank pain or whatever the case may be. Say again, sorry?
Are you saying include that on the list, like in parentheses next to the complication, or just verbalize it during the discussion?
So that your question is a very good one. Look, this case is all about urethral injury, which, by the way, you didn't enjoy doing this case in real life, but from the exam point of view, it's absolutely pure gold. Because it's so easy to predict the question, and you can score highly. So with that understanding in mind, I'm going to tell you, as I will tell all of you with complications, don't shy away from them. Be comfortable to talk about them. And as such, you want to make sure that the examiner sees it. Because if the examiner sees it, they're going to ask you about it. They've been mired in PID and fibroids and AUB all day long. Now they get an interesting case of a urethral injury. They perk up. This is exciting for them. They're not going to say, I don't want to talk to them about ureteric injury. They're going to jump at it. And it's legitimate and it's appropriate because it's a very good, rich exam question. So with that in mind, you want the examiner to see it. So your question, actually, when it comes to how do you write it up, I would simply write up in the complications column, in big, bold, capital letters, you want the examiner to see it, I would write ureteric injury. And you can even write with readmission. Or, you know, but be cryptic. Don't give all the information away. You want to just, A, make sure that the examiner sees it, and B, you want to pique their curiosity, because it's out of that curiosity that they're going to start asking you questions to seek clarification and better understanding. So don't write everything down on paper, because if you do that, you've left yourself nothing to say. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question briefly before we carry on?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Dr. Akshay, you injured the ureter and you didn't even realize it. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So that's number one. That's a tough admission to make. Okay, but you got to take the bull by the horns, and your response was exactly correct. So, you diagnosed it on post-op day number one, work up till post-op day number two. What did you do at that point?
I consulted urology right away. The patient had it fully replaced, but we consulted urology for further assistance.
Okay, and I'm guessing that they took over the case for that for the last 3-4 days or so, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And they had to go in again, I assume?
Correct, yeah. So just for this case, she got a percutaneous nephrostomy tube placed because they were not able to place a stent, and then she got taken care of.
Makes perfect sense. Okay. This is the key thing. How, in retrospect, do you realize you injured the ureter? First of all, the question, the course of the ureter is guaranteed. I'm not a betting guy. I would put money on it that you actually are going to be asked that question. You've got to know it backwards, okay? How do you think it happened?
I think it probably happened when we were taking... when we were transecting the utero-ovarian ligament, I think we may have gotten a little too laterally for this, and then we may have placed a clamp across it, posterior and laterally. I think that's what probably happened.
But you said the utero-ovarian, the ovary would still have been lateral to the clamp, not so?
Yeah, that is correct. But the extravagation occurred... right below the pelvic brim. So it doesn't make sense why it occurred so high. I would have expected it to go to the cervix. But
when you said extravasation, can you be more explicit?
On the CT urogram, there was extravagation of the contract.
Oh, okay.
And then that occurred right after the pelvic brim, which is an unusual spot for ureteral injury.
Okay. Now, Kate, I'm going to put you on the spot here. This is a tough one, okay? You there, Kate?
I'm here.
Okay. He said the injury occurred at the pelvic brim. If you're the examiner, does that make you think of anything that you might want to ask him?
I think I would ask where the ureter is in relation to... maybe the rest of the pelvic sidewall structures, as well as the utero-ovarian structures.
So that's a given. I'm trying to get something a little bit more specific. What I'm trying to get at, if one has, and I don't know if this is your case, actually, but folks, what I'm doing with action now, when you and all of you have complications, we need to dissect these cases out along the lines that I'm doing. Actually, in this case, if you have a Finnish patient and you're using self-retaining retractors, a Balfour retractor for an obese person, for example, those retractors may go too deep and apply pressure on the pelvic brim. And if you catch the ureter there, you might get a compression fracture, compression injury. That really wouldn't give rise to extravasation. But I just want you to be aware of this, because this conversation can go down that road. You got to work out where can the conversation go, okay? All right. what else can we talk about here? Is there any, look, just by the way, for ureteric injuries, the same goes for bowel injuries. You got to know where with ureter is the most common place for it to occur. During what procedure is it most common, and it's an abdominal is most common, although they more commonly occur during vaginal, I believe. But because abdominals are more commonly done, they're more common with abdominals. Where is the injury most common? And then how do you repair? When do you do an end-to-end anastomosis? How many layers do you close in? How many sutures? What kind of sutures? Suture material do you use? Do you use a drain? You need to be able to know one sentence on a Bowrey flap or a psoas hitch. Actually, you definitely need to be able to say one sentence on both of those. The rest of you, it's nice if you can know it, but it's not critical. Understand, every one of you can still get a structured case on ureteric injury, in which case it would be helpful to know these things. But actually, because he's got this case on his list, for him, he must know it, okay? So that you got to know. And the take-home message, if they asked you, would you do anything differently in the future if you had the same case, how would you answer?
I would do a cystoscopy at the end of the case, 100%.
So that's very, very interesting.
Because I would have diagnosed lack of
urine. Yeah, but I'm going to play the devil's advocate with you, which is what your examiner is entitled to do. You had no indication managing this patient prospectively that there was a ureteric injury. So what you are advocating now is on every single hysterectomy, you're going to land up doing a cystoscopy. Am I getting it correct?
Yeah.
So is that a good utilization of resources?
It's not the best.
See, I'm attacking you from both sides now. You can say whatever you want as long as you can legitimately defend it.
I would argue that the benefit of recognizing a ureteral injury earlier outweighs the cost of universal cystoscopy.
Okay, and I'm your examiner, and I will tongue-in-cheek sarcastically turn around to you and say, I don't do this. If I have no suspicion, I don't do a cystoscopy. Are you suggesting what I'm doing is wrong? You see how you don't want to go down that road. Okay. The point that I'm trying to drive home here, you can do whatever you want as long as you can legitimately defend it. But let me take an extreme case. A person comes for weakness and tiredness, AUB, and you do a hemoglobin, a CBC. That's a legitimate blood test, correct? But if you go and do an ACTH stimulation test, is that indicated? Clearly not. And they would look at askance at you for ordering that. So that's a very extreme case. But yeah, a cystoscopy is not indicated on every single hysterectomy. So it's sort of the same issue as with the ACTH stim test. Can you see what I'm getting at, actually?
Yeah, it has to be case-by-case basis, which, you know. Yeah,
correct. And so let me share with you, too, for you personally, but for everyone listening in, how I would answer this. I would say, look, I've got to be honest. I was totally shocked when I diagnosed the ureteric injury, because during the surgery, everything was fine. I felt I knew where the ureters are, and I was very surprised. As a consequence of this case, I have decided for the next couple of hysterectomies, I'm going to do a cystoscopy just to be on the safe side. But I think this is just until I have regained that comfort level that, you know, as long as I can see the ureters and identify them, I'm good. Because I don't think that a cystoscopy is necessary on every single hysterectomy. And so for the next couple of cases, I will do it. But I hope to be able to get back to not having to do it at all. Unless indicated, I should say. Not doing it unless indicated. How does that sound to you, Akshay? And be honest, if you don't like it, let's talk about it.
No, to be honest, that's how I feel. So that's verbalized in a lot better way than what I said. But yeah, I agree.
Okay, because you didn't say that. You said I'm going to do it on every case. And that's actually a significant difference. You lay yourself vulnerable to an accusation of overutilization of resources, okay, which is not good for you, the patient, or the community, okay? So I like the case very much. I like your presentation as well, by the way, but this one issue, I purposely drove us to this direction so I could get that one point across. You've got a pile and a fright. What they love to ask is what organisms did you expect? What antibiotics did you give? I just want to give all of you. I'm just giving it as a rhetorical question. You've got to know that, okay? But for all of you who have cases on your list, pile and a fright in pregnancy. And maybe a post-op complication pilo like this case, as well as PID TOA with admission. And a significant number of you have cases like that. The number of days in hospital, just be very careful what it is. Ideally, it should be certainly, definitely no less than two, maybe two, and three. But no less than two, and probably not more than four. Why do I say that? If you've admitted a patient for pilo, and the same goes for TOA, and she spent only one day in hospital, was she really that sick in the beginning that she needed admission at all? Because keep in mind, you're supposed to keep them on intravenous antibiotics until they defevest, and then remain afebrile for at least 24 hours. So if you've only kept them for one day, you haven't really left yourself much time for that. So that's the argument for a too short a stay. What about the other end? If she spends 4, 5, 6 days in hospital, there's a different issue that you've got to be prepared to defend, and that is you don't want to be seen to be leaving the patient, just languish in hospital while you're not actively doing something for her. So if you've got a five-day stay, you've got to show how every day of those 5 days you were doing something. You were waiting for a lab result, but as soon as the result came, you acted. Don't let the patient be seen languishing in hospital without any active management. And that, if you start approaching 4, 5, 6 days, absolutely that the examiner may think that. So the ideal is 2 to 3 days. If you're any less or any more, be prepared for the conversation that I just mentioned. All right, Akshay, did I answer the questions that you had, or do you have anything else you still want to raise?
No, that was extremely helpful. That was super helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much. That's a great case. All right, Kate, I've got your case in front of me again. It's such a good case from the exam point of view. It's like, actually, we hate having these cases in practice, but from the exam point of view, it's pure gold. So go ahead and present the case to everyone, and then we can chat.
Okay, so we have a 21-year-old Gravida Zero who underwent a left ovarian cystectomy for
an asymptomatic 7-centimeter mature teratoma.
Did you say 7-centimeter?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
She, 1 week post-op, she began to develop nausea and dizziness after otherwise recovering appropriately, and then went on to start her menses, during which she, when going to the bathroom, expelled what appeared to be gauze. She presented to the urgent care, who sent her to the emergency room, confirmed that it had been gauze left vaginally. She underwent...
This was how many days out again, sorry?
1 week post-op.
Okay, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
She underwent CT scan and pelvic exam and lab workup, which was reassuring for no active infection and no further retained foreign objects. She was then brought into the clinic to see me on post-op day 10. And I don't know how much farther you want me to go with that, but I've been saw her.
So look, the issue is the conversation of at hand is operative utensils, let's call it, foreign bodies left in the patient. That's where the conversation is. Am I correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Now, just you wrote something in the email when you submitted it to us. Just abbreviate the balance of what you wrote. Don't take too much time. Just abbreviate it very short, succinctly.
Sure. So when the patient came to see me in the office, I did confirm it was a retained Raytech. A sponge stick had been used during surgery in case any gentle uterine manipulation was needed. At the case closed, my partner had was closing for me as our next patient had been canceled, so I'd gone to my next patient. There were no issues with counts, no concerns for a retained sponge, and no other indication that there had been a retained foreign instrument.
Okay, one potential gray zone. At what point, and you've got to be careful, this is why you got to think about how you're going to present these cases in the exam. You mentioned that your partner finished off the case in some way. At what point did you leave, and what did your partner do?
My partner, so I left after closure of the fascia of the larger incision where the specimen had been extracted. So he stayed to do the subcutaneous closure of the laparoscopic port.
So look, I'm going to go off at a tangent here just to dot the I's and cross the T's. I'm going to ask your opinion here as well, because I've got to be honest, I'm not sure. I know this happens across the country, but from a patient safety point of view, to what extent, and I'm posing the question because I don't know the answer, I think I know the answer, but I'm not sure. To what extent do we have an obligation to stay in the OR until the case is done? So, Akshay, do you have an opinion on this?
I mean, to be honest, you know, once we're closing and if skin ports are closed, and sometimes I work with residents, like the staff and the residents, you know, clean everything up and make sure.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I've seen this happen time and time again. And I think it's accepted, but because you've got this case, Kate, if you can drill down on this issue and find out, I think it is acceptable, and I've seen it happen countless times. But just be absolutely sure about that. And if once you've looked into this, if you're not comfortable with the response that you got, just as an aside, get in touch with me and we can discuss this further. But I think this is okay, but you need to be 100% certain that this is okay. All right?
Okay. And you, do you mean like okay from my hospital policy standpoint, or like if there's
a patient safety point of view, a hospital policy point of view, a personal surgical policy point of view? But
yeah,
at the end of the day,
I can confirm that.
I'm going to confirm. I'm going to fast forward now. At the end of the day, this patient had a foreign body left inside of her, and fortunately, it was contiguous with the outside. It would have been a lot tougher if it was in the abdomen, obviously. So, you know, we're all going to be pretty good at the end of the day. But how do you present this in the exam? I'm going to give you 20 seconds to present this issue of a retained foreign body. What are you going to say?
So I'd say I took this issue extremely seriously, and as soon as I found out what had occurred,
are there any issues that you don't take very extremely seriously? You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
Be very careful about those words. I counsel the patient extensively pre-op. Do you ever not counsel them extensively? Just be careful. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
I know what you mean, but I'm being very picky with you folks because I want you to practice these issues. Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Okay. I'll renege on that. So as soon as I found out the concern at hand, I immediately contacted my my physician lead, who was also my partner in the case. I contacted risk management because I wanted to communicate with the patient, and I wanted to make sure I did that appropriately. Once I was cleared to do that via risk management, I called the patient who desired her mom on the phone. We had a long
Let me fast forward. What did the risk management people who must have looked into this, what did they say?
They said they were fine with me talking with the patient, and of course,
where did they put responsibility for this issue?
Say that again.
Where did they place responsibility for this complication?
I don't know yet. This happened in the last 2 weeks.
Okay. So look, this is the general approach that I want you folks to take with respect to complications that you have. So I would present your case as follows, Kate. I would say this was a very, if they ask you to present case number 16 or whatever, I would say this was a very interesting case of a 21-year-old para zero, gravity zero, who underwent a laparoscopic removal of a 7-centimeter teratoma, which was fine, except for, as you'll see, she had a complication of a retained foreign body in the vagina. I've analyzed this myself, this case. I've gone over it with my partner, with the QA people and the risk management people at the hospital. At the end of the day, it's still ongoing. Or you can say the risk management people felt the issue lay with the swab count, or the person was involved with closing, assuming it's not you. But even if it is you, you say, you know, at the end of the day, this complication happened because since I was the primary physician, and you did write this in your email to us, by the way, since I was the primary physician, the final responsibility is mine, and I do take responsibility for this. It's comforting that the risk management people actually said I was in the clear, but from a personal point of view, I really feel that for the future, what I'm going to do is I can't go ahead and check all the swab counts. That's an operative nursing function, and that's overkill, but I am a little more hesitant to leave the OR prematurely, even though my partner is very capable. Or you could say, you know, I take responsibility for this. This was unfortunate. I've looked at ways that I can change what I'm doing to reduce the risk of this happening again. But I've got to be honest, and I'm not uncomfortable to acknowledge if I've made a mistake. But I think the issue here is that the swab counts have to be correct. That was a key issue here. As much as I wish there was something I could do differently, if I was to manage this patient again tomorrow, I would do exactly the same thing. And I encourage you folks to say that, because when you say that, you're telling your examiner, you know, I've looked at this issue from all angles, and it's my considered opinion that I did the right thing. There's an expression in French, if you'll excuse me, it's in English. It goes like this: shit happens, okay? And if you operate long enough on enough cases, you're going to have complications, despite the best technique that one might have. This is the territory in which we play. And it's okay to say, I've analyzed it, I've looked at it, I've tried to see, can I reduce the risk of this recurring in the future? And I've come to the conclusion that I would be forced to do exactly the same thing and be comfortable to say that.
I have a question.
How does that sound to you, Kay? Kate?
It sounds good, but I want to get your opinion on this. So this is something I talked to my partner about. So where I changed a part of our every gynecologic surgery was that if anything was placed vaginally, regardless of if the surgery was done vaginally, we always did a vaginal sweep at the end to confirm there was nothing left in the vagina. It didn't matter if the counts were correct. And so that is something I said to my partner, I'd really like to escalate that as a measure to implement with our hospital system. Is that like worth saying, or is that kind of like tooting my own horn, like look at me?
So let me ask you, what is the, I like the idea, for just by the way, what's the globally speaking, what's the cost of doing that? Doesn't cost, the
yeah.
only cost, it's an extra 15 seconds of OR time. Okay?
Correct. Yeah. If that. So you just straight do that.
Yeah, you can do it at the same time, yeah. So I would add, instead of saying, you know, I've done everything correctly, I would say the following. You know, I really felt I did everything correctly, and I'm happy to acknowledge if there would have been an error, risk management people also said that we did fine. But nevertheless, what I have decided is, all future cases, I'm just going to do a pelvic exam in any case where foreign material was bodies were put in the vagina. It takes 2 seconds, do a vaginal, make sure there's nothing left behind. That would have prevented such a complication. And that's my modus operandi for going forward. How does that sound to you?
That sounds perfect.
Yeah, and I think that's, folks, the common theme between both these complications that we've had from Kate and Akshay, the way to handle these complications is not to weave and duck and dive and get away from it. You take the bull by the horns and show how you're dealing with it, and you're trying to make yourself better for it. That's the most important thing. Okay, obviously, as long as you don't kill a patient, heaven forbid. But that's the key thing here. Kate, are there any other issues that you've got on this case?
Nope. I mean, and you know, maybe down the line I'll, you know, talk about, I might come back to you asking. I mean, she has some, you know, middle of the night going to the ER, getting what felt kind of like a difficult pelvic exam. She and I are trying to be very proactive in the mental health recovery and emotional health recovery from this to prevent down the line.
Yeah, it's very, I'm so pleased you raised this. Yeah,
but
I just want to add one thing before you finish.
Okay.
Yeah, folks, to everyone listening in, what Kate is saying now is really, it's excellent, because it shows the examiner, you're not just teaching, you're not just treating the medical condition, but you're treating the patient. You're looking at the patient in her entirety, and you're looking at her mental health, and you're not just reacting and responding. You're being proactive. So this is all very, very good. Don't spend too much time on that, but I think it's important to mention it ever so briefly.
Okay.
Anything else, Kate?
That's it.
All right. Very good. Very good. All right,
that's
folks. We're
question for you.
Sorry. Yes, go ahead, actually. Yeah.
So I had I had that right oophorectomy due to hemostasis. I mean, is there, unless I'm questioned about it, do I need to expand upon it? I mean.
So I'm pleased you raised this issue. This is something that every single one of you need to keep in mind. Remember, when you're in the exam room, defending a decision based on what you saw and what you found and what you felt and what you experienced in the OR, realize of the three people in the room, you and your two G1 examiners, your eyes, you were the only one of those three who actually experienced that patient firsthand. So they can't argue with you when you talk about local anatomical issues. So you can say, you know, the anatomy was such, I was dissecting and it was getting harder and harder with more and more bleeding. I was getting closer to the pelvic sidewall, and I felt that the immediate operative risks were not worth the long-term benefits. So I checked to make sure that the ovary on the other side was normal, and then I removed this ovary. How does that sound?
Perfect. Thank you. Yep, perfect.
Yeah. So just remember, folks, look, I'm never going to say that you should lie. Heaven forbid. Don't do that in the exam. But you can, they can't argue with you on issues that you describe in terms of what you saw. What you did, they can argue, but what you saw and what you experienced in the OR, they can't argue with you. And because of that, to a subtle extent, you can embellish it a little bit. But don't be dishonest. It's not a good idea. Does that answer your question, Akshay?
Yep. Thank you so much.
All right. Very good. All right, folks, listen. Firstly, to Akshay and Kate, thank you very much. I hope you found it helpful. I want to encourage you folks, get your friends and colleagues to come and join. It's free. And I invite all of you again to volunteer to submit a case, and let's talk about it. We get excellent feedback from our candidates, and it's all free, so take advantage of it. With that being said, folks, our next teleseminar is going to be in 2 weeks' time, the 31st of March. The 31st of March, today, 2 weeks. So, folks, to Kate and to Akshay, thank you so much. Great cases. And wish you all the best. Stay up to date with your case list. Just a little word of advice. There's no reason whatsoever why you can't finish the office portion of your case list within a week. Just go and pick 40 decent cases and get your office section behind you. That's a third of your case list. For the OB and GYN, at this point, mid-March, I want to encourage you to aim to be within about 3 weeks, 4 weeks maximum, but 3 weeks of having managed the patient, having inputted the data into the computer. And then as the 30th of June approaches, that 3 to 4 week window becomes, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, 2 weeks, 1 week, until you're up to date and there's no last minute cramming. So, folks, that's it. Thanks once again to everyone. We'll meet again on the 31st of March, and this then concludes our teleseminar. Thanks, everyone. Take care.